Okay, so good evening, everyone. Good to see you again. We'll work tonight on the last few tzukim of chapter 3, from Pasuk Chaf Beis, from 22 to 24. But just before then, an additional layer on the last verse from last week, where we learned, because it's going to have relevance for this week, Vayas Hashem Elokim la'adam u'l'ishto kotnot or, vayal b'shem, and Hashem made for Adam and his wife gowns of leather, and we discussed that in detail last week, made from snake skin, vayal b'shem, and he gave it to them to wear. And last week we spoke in depth about the whole Kabbalistic meaning of clothing and this particular item of clothing and how it transformed, what ways it transformed them and so on. The word or, which means leather, it means an animal skin or skin, any skin. So he made them these gowns of skin, and we learned the Targum Yonatan and other Medrashim that say that was this made from the snake. But the Medrash says that B'Torato Shel Rabbi Meir, in Rabbi Meir's version of his Torah, or was spelt two ways. It was spelt either as it is, with an ayin vavrej, which means leather, and in another version it was spelt with an aleph. So in the Torah we know that there are just multiple levels of reading and multiple levels of interpretation. So even each word, each letter, and we've talked about that before, there's the letter as it is, just as a letter of the alphabet. There's the name of the letter, which means something. So the name of each ayin means an eye, vav means a hook, resh means a head. So there's every letter has meaning. So when you string letters together into words and words into sentences, you can expand them, not only by the phonetic sound of each letter, but by the meaning of each letter's name. Each letter has a name. And then each letter has a number. And that's the whole gematria area and how that works out. There are dozens of different ways of calculating the gematriot. And then there's the sound. So, or, if you look at it from the perspective of the letters, is ayin vav resh, and there's a completely different word that has no connection to or with an ayin, which is or with an aleph, which means energy or light. So, and yet, because they're phonetic, because they're from a sound perspective, they're the same, they're phonetically the same, although they're not literally the same, there is a connection. So we connect words by the way they're spelt, we connect words by the way they sound, we connect words by the gematria, we connect words by philosophic meanings. There are all sorts of multiple connections and hyperlinks that take place in the Torah, and the Gemara and the Medrashim and Kabbalah deal with all those multiple levels of linkages that take place all over. And that lattice work is part of the intrigue of understanding a piece of Torah. And this word, or, so in Rabbi Meir's Chumash, he had both versions, like we have a Kri and a Ketuv. Sometimes we have a word that is spelt one way and pronounced another way. Because again, there's a double meaning. There's the way it's the actual spelling of the word and the phonetics of the word. And then they don't always match, and there's a reason for that. So in Rabbi Meir's Torah, there was like a Kri and a Ketuv here. And although spelt Aleph Vav Resh, it was pronounced, he pronounced it as Aleph, Ayin, as it was spelled Ayin Vav Resh, he pronounced it Aleph Vav Resh. Now, in our normal Ashkenazi translation, pronunciation, there's no difference. We pronounce all the same way. But in a Sephardi pronunciation, they're very different. An Ayin would be pronounced gutturally as Or, and an Aleph would be pronounced silently, just as Or. So there would be a difference, and he would pronounce it with an Aleph, not with an Ayin. Or vice versa. He might have written it with an aleph and pronounced it with an ayin. So what does that mean? Kotnot or means a clothing of energetic aura. That's what it means, that he clothed them in an aura, that's where the word aura comes from. Or he clothed them in an aura of energy, of light force that was around them. And we're told that that or was the or of Torah. So Torah is a source of energy. These are things that people so often miss in understanding that Torah is an incredible source of energy. And real energy, real energy. We've got the cases in Chazal of the, I forget who was it, who was sitting and discussing Torah, and the fire that emerged from his head was so hot that the birds that flew above were burnt. That was the level of energy, that of literal physical energy that can be generated through the study of Torah. But there are many more day-to-day examples that one can experience oneself in accessing the energy of the Torah. So the Torah is an amazing source of energy. The reason we learn regularly is not just to know the Torah, you're supposed to know the Torah, but even if you knew the Torah, you still have a mitzvah to learn. And the mitzvah to learn is not about knowing the Torah. The mitzvah to learn is about linking and synchronizing and connecting to the energy of the Torah. Because one's whole capacity to function in the world is different when you're plugged in. It's literally like being plugged in. And you're only plugged in at the times you're learning. And yes, you can plug in the morning and your mind can keep on consciously and subconsciously working on things, and that can drive you for a longer period during the day. But not longer than a day, which is why we make a Birkat HaTorah every morning. And according to the Vilna Gaon, it doesn't matter whether you slept or you didn't sleep, the next morning it doesn't work anymore. You've got to re-energize yourself. You can't keep going the next morning on the Torah energy of the day before. And that's why a Talmid Chacham is a different species of being. A Talmid Chacham is not a person who learns. He's a different species of person. He operates in a different way. His values are different. He thinks differently. He accesses the world differently. He sees the world differently. He's a different person. And when is he a Talmid Chacham? That's not a status that you get and then you've got forever. It's when he's involved in learning. When a person is involved in deep learning, not in superficial learning, that doesn't do a whole lot other than give one familiarity with the Torah. But it doesn't connect one with the energy force of the Torah. But a Talmid Chacham is somebody who's plugged in. So then the way he sees is with a different energy. The way he feels is with a different energy. The way he interprets, the insights he has, all of that is with a different level of energy. And so that's the Kotnot Or. So let's now put that together with what we learned last week. And what we learned last week was that this Ktonet Or, this gown of leather, was part of his image. This was part of his outer manifestation, not that which was inside him. So what is this Kotnot Or? We say that's Torah. Why is it referred to metaphorically here as a tunic, as a uniform, as a garment, if it's the Torah? So we see that something interesting has happened here. The Zohar tells us that Eitz HaChaim was the energy of Torah. So eating from the Eitz HaChaim was accessing Torah. Now again, whether that meant literally that there was a fruit that you ate, or it meant learning, but it was the Zohar says the Pnimiyut of Torah. It was the inside of Torah. It was the soul of Torah. That's what the Eitz HaChaim was. It wasn't just a magical elixir that if you ate, you live forever. It was plugging in. Through the Eitz HaChaim, you could plug into the very essence of Torah, Torah at its soul, Torah at its source. Something we weren't able to do subsequently until Sinai. That was the next time we were able to plug into Torah at its source. Never in between or subsequently have we been able to. So when Adam eats from the Eitz HaDaat and now is about to be prevented from access to the Eitz HaChaim, to that Pnimiyut HaTorah, to that essence of Torah, he's given Torah as an external garment. What does that mean? So now Torah has to be accessed from outside. It can no longer be, it's not intuitive, it's not instinctive anymore. So before that time, it was instinctive, but there was Pnimiyut HaTorah. And had Adam eaten from the Eitz HaChaim, the Torah would have merged totally with his being to the point that it would have been one and the same. His being would have been a being of Torah, that's why he wouldn't ever have died. And it would have all been internal, it would have been from the inside out. Now the Torah has to be absorbed. You have to dress yourself in Torah. You have to wrap yourself in Torah. You have to immerse yourself in Torah. That's why we talk about Torah like water. That's how you interact with water. You immerse yourself in it. And that's how you purify yourself in a mikveh, is by immersing yourself in the water. Torah you have to immerse yourself in. You can't stand out. And that's why there was always so much opposition to Torah being taught in secular institutions or in a secular way. And that's why, in the case of Valozhin, they rather closed the yeshiva than introduced one period of math once a week. That's all the government wanted, one period of math once a week. And Chaim Valozhin said at the time that people don't get it. If you introduce secular study into a yeshiva, it's not the introduction of secular study, it makes Torah study a secular study. So now you've got studies, you've got math and you've got Torah. And now they're on the same. You've got math, like you've got today. People have got study, they go and they study and they learn Torah. You miss it completely if you put it on that kind of level. It's not a subject. It's not a subject you can master. It's not a subject you can study. You can only immerse yourself in it. And if you immerse yourself in it, you can't be studying other stuff at the same time. So when you look at the way secular knowledge is taught, it's taught through mastery. So you're given information, you're given knowledge, and you're meant to master it, and then to answer questions on it and to show your mastery, whether through passing an exam or writing a thesis. You're meant to demonstrate your mastery. In Torah, there is no mastery. In Torah, you've got to demonstrate that you have been mastered by Torah, not that Torah has mastered you. It's a completely different approach. Torah enwraps you. Torah is your clothing. Torah surrounds you. And you are now governed by it. You are mastered by it. Your behavior is governed by Torah. So the test of a Talmid Chacham is not in how much he knows. It's the way he sees the world. It's the way he reacts. It's the way he behaves. That's what determines. There's no test. You can't take a Talmid Chacham exam. You can't get a Talmid Chacham degree. Smicha means nothing. So how do you? What is a Talmid Chacham? Talmid Chacham is determined by his behavior, not determined by his knowledge. The behavior is a reflection of the knowledge that has been integrated completely. So since the time of the Chet, since Adam HaRishon's choice to eat from the tree, he gets access to the Torah now as an external garment that he has to wear and fit into and be embraced in, and it begins to model him. So now the Torah becomes part of the energy, his outward energy. People can now feel his Torah. It's not just something inside. They can actually feel the Torah. They can access the Torah of Adam HaRishon. And so it is today with great Talmidei Chachamim, that you can actually feel their greatness and you can feel their Torah as something that exists outside. There is an aura about them. It's not just a matter of knowledge. So his whole relationship with spirituality and with the Torah changes from purely internal to something that starts as external and needs to be internalized. Originally it was internal and needed to be externalized, and now it's external and it needs to be internalized. Completely different approach. And of course the danger now exists the same as with clothes. The danger now becomes the Torah becomes part of the ego instead of part of the self. So when Torah was naturally internal, Torah was hidden inside oneself, and there wasn't a danger of it being used for ego. But now that it's an external manifestation, it can be used as ego. It can be used in a negative way, just as garments can be used negatively. So all of this is quite important for the next piece. Before we go on to the next piece, if you have pencil and paper, then I'm going to give you an exercise to do. If you don't have pencil and paper, do the exercise mentally. Then you need memory. If you don't have pencil and paper, you need memory. If you have neither pencil and paper nor memory, then I feel sorry for you. That's a hard kind of life.
Just enjoy the here and now.
Just enjoy the here and now. Yeah, just live in the present, as they say. So here's the exercise, and nobody's going to ask you to share what you write, so you can be honest. And what I would like you to write is five, if possible, if you can think of five, of your deepest, biggest fears.
Only five?
Five. Yeah, don't keep going. Stop after five.
Get you. or cosmic fears?
Your own fears, what you're afraid of. You're afraid of the cosmos, then put the cosmos in. You've only got three fears. That's good.
Yeah,
three fears is fine.
Three
is fine. If you've got many and somebody else has only got three, you can lend yours to the. You can share. You can share your fears. Yeah. The okay. So let's we'll come back to that list at the. Okay, good. The we'll come back to them at the end of the shiur. So now start some very peculiar, difficult psukim, and all of this, the whole of Bereshit, from the beginning of the creation right until the pieces we're doing now, we have to understand. The Ari says these are not things that are even understandable. These are such deep Kabbalistic ideas, every word of it, that we can't really get a strong sense of it. And yet we need to try and make some kind of sense of it. But these psukim are really hard. Vayomer Hashem Elohim, and Hashem Elohim said, let's just translate it literally, first of all. Hein ha'adam haya ke'achad mimenu. Oh, my goodness, says Hashem, Adam has become like one of us. Lada tovara, knowing good and bad. Ve'ata, now, pen yishlach yado ve'lakach gam me'etz ha'chaim, ve'achal v'chai lo'olam. What will happen if he stretches out his hand and takes from the etz ha'chaim, and he'll eat from it and live forever? So Ve'yishalcheu Hashem Elokim Migan Eden. So Hashem expels him from Gan Eden, La'avodet Adama Asher Lukach Misham, to serve the land, to work the ground, the land from which he was taken. Ve'yagarish et Adam, and he chased Adam out of the garden. Ve'yashkein Mikedem Began Eden et Akruvim Ve'et La'at Echere Ve'mitapet Et Shmor, and he placed east of Eden the angels with a double fiery sword to guard it, l'lishmor et derech etz ha'chaim, to protect the roads to the etz ha'chaim. So Adam couldn't come back and find his way to the etz ha'chaim and find eternity that way. So clearly the first difficulty is just it sounds so small and mean, doesn't it? Now Hashem's worried, all of a sudden he's like one of us, we don't want any more gods and angels around here, let's keep him. It just sounds so funny. What is really going on? But even stranger than this, than the superficial meaning, is the Medrash. And this is what the Medrash says. The Medrash says the superficial meaning doesn't make a whole lot of sense for many reasons, and so you have to read it on a deeper Kabbalistic level. And that is, Amar Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana. Rabbi Abba Bar Kahana said, this is in the Medrash in Parashat Chaf Aleph, at this moment, Hashem offered Adam an opportunity to do tshuva. We don't hear that part of the story, do we? That God actually says to Adam, okay, you've sinned, you have one chance. You can do tshuva at this moment. And that's the word va'ata. Ata means you have a moment, in this moment. That's what ata means, ata with an ayin. The ata, and now. So the Medrash takes this ba'ata as a sentence on its own, as a whole phrase on its own, not just a word. The literal translation of ba'ata means, and now? But why does that, you don't need that word. That word is totally superfluous. And now, what's ba'ata? The Medrash says there's something else going on here altogether. The word ba'ata means tshuva. As we see from the introductory words of the Parsha of Tshuva, which is in Sefer Devarim, where Hashem says, "Va'ata Yisrael, Ma Hashem Elokecha Shoel Mimcha," and now Jewish people, what does Hashem want from you? Just to hold him in awe and to serve him. That's all that he asks, and that's the beginning of the Parsha of Tshuva. So the atah, that word, the atah, not only because it introduces the parish of Tshuva and Bereshit, but also because of the atah, that idea of a moment, that in a moment one can do Tshuva. So for example, the din is that if a wicked man, somebody we know is completely wicked, he breaks every single law in the Torah, there isn't one that he keeps, and he takes a ring out and he meets a girl, he calls two witnesses and a rabbi. You don't really need the rabbi, but let's say he was there too. And he says in front of the two witnesses to the girl, giving her a ring on her finger, with this ring you are Mekudesha to me, you are my wife, on condition that I am actually a tzaddik. So if I'm a tzaddik, we're married. And if I'm not a tzaddik, we're not. So whether or not you can go out with anybody else depends now on whether I'm a tzaddik or not. What is the din? We know he's a Rasha. The din is, she's married. Because we have to treat her as married, because he might have had a moment of teshuva. He might have been so in love with her that he had a moment of teshuva, and even though a moment later it's gone, at that moment he might have done teshuva, and at that moment he might have been a tzaddik. That's the power we have in a moment. We can transform our souls from rishaim into tzaddikim, from wicked people into righteous people, in one moment we can do that. We might not be able to stay there, but we can do it. We know Yom Kippur comes and we kind of reach certain heights if we're fortunate, and a few hours after Yom Kippur it's all gone. But still, at those moments of Yom Kippur we reach very high levels, and we were able to do things and see things and understand things and undertake things that we normally aren't able to do. That's the power of Teshuvah. Teshuvah can be in a moment. Teshuvah, there's no procedure, there's no... Yes, if you want to do a proper Teshuvah, there is a process, but one can have hirurei tshuva, one can have a moment of tshuva, which is just in one's head, where you really feel strongly. So what do you need for there to be tshuva? You've got to accept that you've done wrong, you've got to feel remorse and regret for having done wrong, and you've got to undertake to live a better life in the future. Those three things can happen in an instant. And in that instant, you can become a tzaddik. That's the meaning of the atah. So God says to Adam, atah, now is your moment. And he waits. And Adam answers, pen. That's not God talking. That, says the Medrash, is Adam. And pen is a strange word. Pen means, maybe. That's what pen means, maybe. That's why it can't be God talking, because God never says maybe. God knows the future. God wouldn't say, maybe he'll stretch out his hand and eat from the tree. God knows, will he or won't he? What is the maybe? So the maybe is not him, the maybe is Adam. So what is he saying maybe about? So Hashem says, now is your moment to do tshuva. Adam says, maybe. What does that mean? Why would he say maybe? Clearly, here's one of our proofs for something we've been working on all the way through since the beginning of this parasha. Adam didn't believe he did wrong. And even at this moment, when God says, here's your chance to do tshuva, you're about to be thrown out of Gan Eden, and says, I'm not so convinced that what I did was so wrong. I'm still not so convinced. I think I made the right choice. Or I might have made the right choice. Now, says God, if you don't even realize you've made the right choice, you made the wrong choice, if you think you're still a tzaddik, you could go and eat from the Etz HaChaim, which I never prohibited you from doing. I only prohibited you from eating from the Etz HaDaat. So now you could go to the Etz HaChaim. If you knew you had sinned, you would never do that, and I wouldn't have to throw you out of Gan Eden. Why wouldn't you go and eat from the Etz HaChaim? So we're going to understand the meaning of death, and why it becomes so important. But in simple terms, Hashem is saying, if you would know what you did, I wouldn't think that you would want eternity. Now that you think you've done nothing wrong, I fear you might want eternity. And therefore, and now we read the pasuk the different way. Pen yishlach yado v'lakach gam eitz hachaim v'achal v'chai l'olam. Now I'm worried. Now that you've said pen, you've said no. When I said va'ata, I said you've just got this moment, and in that moment, you weren't absolutely sure of the possibility of tshuva, and that you had done wrong. Now I'm worried that you're going to seek eternity. And that would be devastating. Why? And we'll come to the why in a moment. The Medrash goes on very beautifully and says, "Vayeshachehu Hashem Elokim miGan Eden," and Hashem now has to send him out of Gan Eden, to expel him from Gan Eden. Kivan sheshelacho, once he sent him out, hitchil mekonen alav. He started saying kinos. Hashem started saying kinos. What we say in Tisha B'av. Hashem sat on the ground and cried and read Eicha. This was the beginning of the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. It was the beginning of all of destruction, the beginning of death, the beginning of deterioration, the beginning of disease. Everything everything negative was starting at that moment. And what is his kina? His kina comes earlier. And there's discussion as to why it's earlier. Hein Adam... Ha'adam haya ka'achad mimenu. This Adam, he could have been one of us. And look at him now. Look what we lost. It's like the loss of the Beis Hamikdash. Hashem sees the loss. Adam misses it. Isn't that the tragedy? And that's probably the tragedy of all our lives. Hashem sees who we could be all the time. Hashem sees who we could be. And we miss it. And we miss it. And we miss it. And we underrate ourselves. And when we do rate ourselves high, it's usually in the areas that don't count that much. In the areas that do count, we don't rate ourselves that high. Then we get very modest. I'm a tzaddik, I'm just an ordinary Jew. but in other areas, we're ready to rate ourselves really, really high. I'm professional, I'm a businessman, I'm one of the best businessmen. I'm an author, I'm one of the best authors. We're quite ready to say that. Are you a saint or are you a tzaddik? So when it comes to tzitkus, we don't understand who we could be. Hashem does. And the aggravation that causes Hashem, imagine what that's like. We know what it's like with our own children if we see them going on a path where we know they could do so much better and they could be so much more. We know what that feels like. Imagine with Hashem, we've got millions of children. And with each one, he sees what each one could be. And here it starts with Adam. And he says to Adam, I just need you for a moment. Just feel the loss for a moment. And you'll be fine. And I said, maybe. So Hashem breaks down, sits down, and says kinas. Takes out his echa and he reads. And if you remember the word echa, where does it first appear? Ayeka, right after the chet, right after he eats from that. Hashem says, Ayeka, spelt, the Medrash says, spelt echa. That's the beginning of Eicha. It's the beginning of the downfall. Hashem is the first being to read Eicha, to feel Eicha, to react and respond with an Eicha. Now the Medrash says also further on, and we'll then string this all together and we'll come back to your notes. Amar Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi kashir b'ra'o. When Hashem created man, b'ra'o b'midat hadin u'b'midat harachamim. Hashem used both midat hadin and midat harachamim. So we're always, our lives are balanced between din, which is justice. There's a right and wrong. There's a good and bad. There is moral judgment in our lives. We don't believe that there's no judgment and everything's okay and that everybody's got their own way of seeing it. There is a right and a wrong. There's a true and there's a false. And that's how God created man. Uchashit terado, and when he threw him out, when he expelled him, terado b'midat hadin v'midat harachamim. That too employed both of those midot, justice and mercy. So the justice, I understand, he sinned, he had disobeyed, and from God's perspective, I gave you something to do, you didn't keep it, you disobeyed, so out of Gan Eden. I understand the din, where's the rachamim? Look what comes as a result of this. As a result of this comes out not only his own death, but everybody's death, the introduction of disease, of deterioration, of moral deterioration, of historic degeneration, ultimately of the destruction of two temples and all the terrible tragedies that mankind has been through and that the Jewish people, it all starts here. Where's the rachamim? What's so merciful about that? So that we have to understand. in terms of the Ramban in this coming week's parasha. So the Hashem says to Moshe after the golden calf, go and tell the people, etc. Emor b'nei Israel, atem am k'she oref, you're a stiff-necked people. This is in chapter 33, verse 5. One minute, I'm going to come amongst you and wipe you out. The ata and now, strange phrase. Horeid et yicha me'alecha. The English translated, I don't know where from. Take your jewelry off. And then I'll figure out what to do with you. And et yicha more literally means your adornments. It doesn't have to be jewelry. It's your decorations. It might be your medals. Anything which makes you feel important. And the Jewish people took off their adornments from Har Chorev. So these seem to be adornments they got at Sinai. What does it mean? Unkelus says something even stranger. He translates it not as jewelry, but tikun zeinech, your weapons. What weapons did they get at Sinai? So the Ramban gives a bit of background and says about Unkelus, he quotes Unkelus, who calls it weapons. Da'ato k'divrei ha'omer b'vrei shidraba, this is based on a medrash. Zeina'ut chigei lahem. God gave them weaponry. Klomar. That Hashem girded them at the time of the giving of the Torah, the force, the weapons with which to defeat disease and death. So he gave them eternity. But eternity isn't something which you just have. Eternity you have to fight for. That's why it's called a weapon. It's a battle to overcome death and to overcome disease, but Hashem gave them the tools with which to do that. And that was the Torah. But to know how to use it. V'heim shmotav shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, these are Hashem's names. So it's not just the Torah as it is, but how to find within the Torah the actual names of Hashem and how to use those to find eternity. V'hinei Yisrael kiblu aleihem et hamita beratzon nafshan b'pnei onesh ha'ivu. And the Jewish people voluntarily gave up those weapons so as to accept upon themselves the consequence of death. Thanks for that. To accept upon themselves the consequence of death as an atonement for the ego. This was an act of amazing tshuva, that they were able to say, you've given us the ability to defy death, we'll give that up as an atonement for the ego. So what's all that about? And we need to look at it on a few different levels. The one level is, let's bring it down to simple terms. What is a value? When we talk about a value, what does that mean? And why do we use the same term as we use for a piece of property? Hmm. Say to you, what is the value of this property? What is the value of this house? What is the value of this watch? What is the value? Purely monetary terms. And we also talk about values, honesty, integrity, and all those wonderful elevated ideas. Why do we even use the same word?
Is that a question or is that a term?
Well, it's a question for you to think about. I'll give you the answer. Why do you think about it? I've been thinking about it for 50 years. I don't expect you to have the answer to the question and have the answer. So a value, like a piece of property, a value is something you pay for. A value has no meaning if you don't pay for it. If you don't pay for it, everybody has good value. Because there's no cost. Why not have a good value? So in research that I've done, for example, with prisoners, criminals, they've all got good values. I haven't yet found anybody, anywhere, in all the time I've been doing this work, I haven't found one person who has bad values. How would I know that? How do you test for values? That's a simple way. You ask them how they want to raise their children. And you can go to a hardened criminal in prison, and he will never say, I want my children to land up here like me and be robbers and thieves and fraudsters. They don't say that. They would like their children to grow up like good people. So they've got good values. Everybody's got good values. That's not what makes the difference. What makes the difference is how much are you willing to pay? That's where people express the values. Everybody believes in good things. And how much are you willing to pay for honesty? How much are you willing to pay for Shabbos? When the Jews came from Eastern Europe to the United States, there were some who paid terrible prices to keep Shabbos. They couldn't earn, they couldn't get jobs, they had nothing to eat. But breaking Shabbos didn't enter their minds as a possibility. It wasn't even a possibility. And other Jews who broke it very easily, even if they didn't have any problems, and other Jews who would love to have kept Shabbos, but what can you do? Things are difficult and you've got to raise a family, and what can you do? And how often have we heard that? That determines how valuable something is to you. How valuable something is by you value by how does it work in economics? How do you determine value? How much is the market willing to pay? Mm-hmm. Doesn't help what you think it is. I can say I think this watch is worth $1 million. Who wants to pay $1 million? Nobody. Then it isn't worth $1 million. Doesn't matter what I think. So I think Shabbos is very important. I keep Shabbos. But would I pay a price for Shabbos? Not so much. So that means it's not really valuable to me. So that's why we call it a value. Because the value is by the price you're willing to pay for the things that you believe in. So now, imagine Adam, as Hashem says, we'll read the Psukim now in their more simple way again, and we'll learn it according to the Sforno. So Hashem says, Hey, Ha'adam hayaka achad mimenu, Adam has become like one of us, Ladat Tov V'ra. Now, let's go back to the way we translated Ladat Tov V'ra months ago when we were introduced to the Eitz Hadat Tov V'ra. If you remember, we said that means intimate knowledge of. That comes from intimacy. Vayeda Adam et Chava Ishto. It's intimacy. And Tov V'ra means things that are good and bad. So, and we talked about the merging of passion with imagination. And we talked about how imagination alone is not dangerous, and passion alone is not dangerous. But when passion and imagination merge, it becomes very dangerous, because now you can picture the things you want. And that becomes very, very powerful. It's not just an imagination, you can actually picture it. So Hashem says now Adam is dangerous because he knows Tov V'ra intimately, as I do, says God, as we, the angels, do. We know the stuff. We made it. We created it. God says, I know evil, I know pleasure, I know passion, I know it all. I know everything the human being can get up to. But Adam now knows that too. And he has the imagination, and he has the passion. This is an intoxicating cocktail. This is dangerous. All I need now is that he eats from the Eitz HaChaim. So what would happen? So let's say he ate from them. What's so terrible? So he would live forever. What's so terrible? Why would that be so bad? Because when we talk about value, you can only value something in terms of a currency. You've got to value something in terms of something which is in short supply. You can't say, how much air would you be willing to pay for my watch? It doesn't tell me anything about the value, because air is in abundant supply. If I ask you, how many diamonds would you be willing to give? That's different. How much gold would you be willing to give me? That's a different thing. When we talk about money, money is a measure of time. That's all money is. It's a measure of time. Money takes time to earn. Whether you've invested it and it takes time to grow, or you've worked for it and you've taken time to earn it, money is a function of labor, of skills, of talent, and time that work together. But time is a key element of money. So $1,000 for a minimum wage laborer is a lot of labor, is a lot of time. $1,000 for a top lawyer in the country is a few minutes, not a big deal. Because it just depends, how long does it take you to earn it? How easy is it for you to earn it? That's what determines. Currency is just a measure of time, of time and labor. So if we could live for eternity, then what? Time has no value. And if time has no value, money has no value. If I say my watch costs $1 million, you would say, okay, so I'll buy it in 250 years' time. I'll save up and I'll keep it for me. Put it aside for me. I'll come back in 250 years and now by then I'll have $1 million for you. So there is no value. What gives everything value is the one resource which is truly in short supply. And that's time. Not, money's not in short supply. You can make money. You can inflate money. You can do what you want with money. Money's not in short supply. The only thing that is truly in short supply is time. And if Adam would have... Before Adam ate from the Eitz HaDaat Tov V'Ra, and he didn't have this intoxicating cocktail of passion and imagination, it didn't matter that he didn't that he had endless time, because he had values naturally. He only knew good. There weren't values. The concept of values didn't exist, because everything was good. He only knew good. So time didn't have to have a value. You didn't need a measure. You didn't need to measure morality. You didn't need to measure anything. But if you've eaten from the Eitz HaDaat Tov V'Ra, now you have a problem. Now if you have unlimited time, what will stop you from being degenerate? I'll be degenerate for 500 years, and then I'll do tshuva, and then I'll go to Israel and learn a yeshiva in 500 years, maybe 1,000 years time. What's the big deal? Meanwhile, I'll have a good time. There's no urgency. Nothing has value. That's the danger, says Hashem. This wouldn't be good for man. So let me give him one chance, the Ata, Adam, turn. Maybe, says Hashem, then you don't get it. And then there's no way that you can have access to eternity, because you will lose all values. Value and values. So it's a midat harachamim, as the Medrash says. Out of mercy to you, I'm giving you death. I'm giving you finality. I'm giving you shortage of time. That's what death means, shortage of time. I'm giving you a limited amount of time as a gift to you. Because without that, you would have no values. You would have no ability to become the great human being you chose to become when you actually ate from this tree. You wouldn't be able to. The only chance you've got of becoming great is by limiting your time. So Hashem gives that to them, and gives him death. And the next time in history, at Har Sinai, Hashem once again offers them eternity. And says, you've now accessed the Torah at its source. That's like the Eitz HaChaim. You're back to before the sin. And they mess up with the Yegel. And Hashem says again, out of mercy, give up the armor. Give up the arms. Because they will give you eternity, and the last thing you want is eternity.
Give up the arms?
The arms, A-R-M-S. The arms, the weaponry. Give up the weaponry. Because these are weapons against death, and you need death. You need death desperately. Because without death, you've got an unlimited time. With unlimited time, there is no value. There is no limitation on anything. And if there's no value, there are no values, because they go hand in hand. So that's the piece that Hashem says. And so the Reb Chaim Shmulevitz, when teaching that piece of Ramban, used to say it's not just that they gave up their weaponry as an atonement. They gave up their weaponry in the realization it wouldn't serve them. It wouldn't be good for them to have that eternity. It wouldn't be good for them to be able to battle death using the name of Hashem or any other means. They needed to be able to succumb to the limitations of a limited life. And exactly the same with Adam and Chava. There's one other level as well, which is an easier level even to understand, and that is that being in these very high circumstances, so living in the Garden of Eden, that imposes a huge burden of responsibility on a person. Because of the expectations on you. You can't live in the Garden of Eden the same way as you live outside of it. And there too, Hashem sending them out of the Garden of Eden is also an act of mercy. For you to have to live with your compromised state of being in this kind of an environment places too much of a gap between who you should have been and should be and who you really are. It's just not a place you want to be, so you want to live beyond that. Now this sending out of the Garden of Eden, the Medrash says, the same thing happens again and again in history. This process is not so unusual. So the Midrash says in Parsha Yutet, Ma Adam HaRishon, just as with Adam HaRishon, Hichnastiv b'toch Gan Eden, I brought him into Gan Eden, v'tzivitiv, I gave him mitzvahs, v'avar al tzivuyah, and he transgressed those mitzvahs, v'danti oto b'shiruchin, so I judged him with expulsion, u'v'gerushin, and with divorce. V'konanti alav eicha, and then I said eicha, then I cried. And then it goes through the various psukim to prove that. And then it says, Af banav, the same applies with Adam's children. Hichnastim le'etz Israel, I bring them into Israel. So now Israel is being compared to Gan Eden. Tzivitatim, I commanded them, v'avru ala tzivui, and they disobeyed me. Danti otam b'shiruchim, I expelled them with a gerushim, and I divorced them, v'konanti aleim eicha, and I sang eicha. The same historically, we have this repeated. So the understanding that Israel too demands a lot more of us. And that's something that we don't always feel sufficiently. We see Israel as a tourist destination sometimes, and that's not what it is. It's like living in a shul. That's how you should feel in Israel. You're living in a shul. You're living in a makom kadosh. And the same as it's difficult nowadays. I was going to say here in the United States, but it's not only here now. I think it's all over. People have lost a sense of appropriateness. To a large degree, that how you behave differently in different places. You behave differently on Venice Boardwalk from the way you behave in a shul. It's not the same. Even if you're a decent human being, and the way you behave on Venice Boardwalk might not be the way that others behave, but still it wouldn't be the same way as you behave when you're in shul. You dress differently when you're in shul. You speak differently when you're in shul. You act differently. When the Sefer Torah is out and being read, certainly then you wouldn't even... You don't even speak in some shuls. Sefer Torah is out, so you don't speak. You stand at attention, and you listen. The Torah is being given. The Torah is being read. It's Hashem's voice. What could be more important? How would you be talking to somebody at that time? And now, as I say, people don't have a sense of occasion. They sit in shul, not on Shabbos, with their cell phones on, checking emails. It's just weird. There's no sense of where you are and what's happening around you. That's what a Beit Knesset is, and that's what a Beit Midrash is, and that's what Eretz Yisrael is. So to live in Eretz Yisrael is extremely difficult. I remember Rabbi Sternbuch, who's the head of the Eda HaCharedis, once said to me that he went to see Motel Pagamansky. Motel Pagamansky was one of the great Gedolim of the pre-war period, and he survived the war. And I don't think he ever got to Israel. He's buried in Israel, but he was living in Montreux at the time, I think, in Switzerland. And Rabbi Sternbuch went to visit him and said, I've come to say goodbye to you. I'm going on Aliyah. I'm going to Israel. And Motel Pagamansky and Rabbi Sternbuch told me, looked at him in total shock. I said, you're going to Israel? Aren't you scared? And he wasn't talking about being scared of Arabs. He was talking about how are you going to live with that kind of level of Kedusha around you all the time. One of my mentors in Rabbeim, Rabbi Lipschitz, said once when he was looking for a place to live in Jerusalem after the Six-Day War and somebody offered him an apartment in the old city overlooking the Kotel, he said, are you out of your mind? Do you think I'm going to brush my teeth every morning in front of the Kotel? Forget it. I'm not going to do it. But we think, oh, they've got a house in front of the Kotel. Isn't that amazing? Well, it's amazing if you're a Kohen Gadol. It's not amazing if you're watching TV. It doesn't work. It's not appropriate. And we don't get it. We don't understand that. So it was a chesed for Adam to be sent away from the Garden of Eden. You can't stay there. It's just too much for you. And it was a chesed in a strange way. As much as Hashem cries about it, it's a chesed that we couldn't keep Israel when the Beit HaMikdash, we couldn't keep the Beit HaMikdash. We couldn't manage it. We couldn't handle it. And we have to be very careful with Eretz Israel today as well. Are we going to be able to keep it? And keeping it doesn't mean necessarily that, from a military perspective, and from although that too, even just from a socio-political level, are we going to be able to keep it as a Jewish state? Are we going to keep it as a place in this kind of crazy democratic world? It's a miracle. The biggest miracle of all is that the world allows us to operate non-democratically in Israel. And how long is that going to last for? Before we have to give equal votes to everybody and Israel's been very liberal with its borders, as have many other countries. And how long does it take when the demography changes? And it's not just Arabs. Today in Israel, there, how many non-Jews are there from all over the world or doing all sorts of things in Israel with possibly a claim to residence at some point? How long will we be able to keep it? Will we have the merit? Are we sensitive? Is Israel important enough to us as a makom kadosh, not just as a refuge for Jews to go because of anti-Semitism? That's a ghetto. Do we want to think of Israel as a ghetto? Just a place for Jews to live, protected by the governments of the world? That's a ghetto. And God forbid it could be a ghetto. Just a very big ghetto with a wall and fence around it that the Jews govern themselves because the world allows them to, for as long as the world allows. That's not an independent state, that's a ghetto. If we really want autonomy and we really want Eretz Israel to be ours, it has to be, we have to use it for what it was given to us for. And it wasn't given to us as a place to run when things get rough in France. That's not what Israel is for. Israel was not given as a refuge. Israel is a mokum kodesh because we can achieve spiritual heights there that we can't achieve anywhere else. But if we don't use it for that, we lose our rights to it, God forbid. And then it just becomes a country which we've got to keep by force for as long as we're able to do so, if we're able to do so. But not by the zchut, not by the rights of the Jewish people to have access to a mokum kodesh, to a place which is holy. But who makes it holy? We do or we don't. I remember the beautiful story of my great uncle Rebellia coming to Israel for the first time when he came Aliyah from England. He was a man of 70, I think, at the time. And he got off the plane, and on the tarmac there was a cigarette butt. And he got out, and he picked it up, and put it in his pocket, and walked a little further, and picked another one. He soon realized that he's going to be busy picking garbage up. He couldn't believe that people dropped things on the floor of Eretz Israel. This is a Beit HaMikdash, this is a shul. We don't drop things on the floor. But we do, we don't care, we don't have that sense of awareness. So that's part of the kindness, the rachamim, that Hashem says to Adam, this is not a place for you to live. You'll have a better life outside of Gan Eden, and maybe you'll work towards coming back here one day. But you've got to get yourself up to that level. So what's interesting about the list of fears that you might have written or might have thought in your mind is I would suggest that in essence there's only one fear we have. The only thing we fear is loss. There's nothing else we fear. And that's why people who don't have anything don't have a lot of fear either. The more we have to lose, the more we fear. We fear loss of money, we fear loss of health, we fear loss of relationship, we fear loss of love, we fear loss of family, we fear loss of job, we fear, if you look at your list, I would be very surprised if anybody's got anything on their list that isn't a fear of some form of loss. Yeah. We fear loss. The other interesting thing about your list that many of you will find, not necessarily all of you, but many of you will find that very few, if any, of those fears have ever happened. And there's a good chance that many of them, or most of them, or all of them even, will never happen except fear of death, if that's one of the things you put down, that will happen. But the others might never happen. And in most cases haven't happened. And sometimes they have, and you've got through them, you're okay. Sometimes you put something on there, and I've often had people who've put fears on there, that terrible things that have happened, they said they feel, but they feel good, they're okay. Well, sometimes they don't even put it on their list. People have been through terrible poverty, and they don't put fear of poverty. They've been through it. They can manage, they can do it. They know they can do it. Whatever it is that one's put down there, the first thing is you'll find they're all fear of loss. The second is you'll find often there are things that haven't happened, and that possibly will never happen. So why are they on the list? Why are we spending time worrying about things? And it's something about worry, and you've heard that how many times. If you're worried about something, just firstly write it down, kind of get rid of it, and secondly just really, is that what you're worried about? What are the chances? It hasn't happened yet. It might not happen. Worry about it when it happens. Why are we so worried about all these things in the future? Many of them don't even happen. Because it has happened. We have lost. We lost Gan Eden. And that's built into our DNA. It's built into our muscle memory. We know the pain of loss. We know the loss of potential. We know the loss of eternity. We know the loss of Torah. We know the loss of bliss, of Gan Eden. We know what that was to lose. And that's unfortunately another way that we value things. So the one way we value things is through time. With abundant time, we don't place a value. And the other is through the ability to imagine loss. Unfortunately, sometimes we only value things after we've lost them. That's very sad. But we can also value things by imagining their loss. So worry and fear is one of the tools of value. The fact that you're afraid of something means it's important to you. If you weren't afraid of losing health, then you're taking health for granted. It's not important to you. If you're not, or you've just never thought about it. If you're not afraid of losing a love relationship, then how important is it really to you? Our fears are measures of the value. That's what a fear is. It's a fear of losing something that is really valuable to us. And your fears will tell you a lot about yourself. But so I'm not going to ask you to read them out because they give away everything. Your fears will tell you what's important to you. So do you fear that, God forbid, your children or grandchildren will not be B'nai Torah? Is that on anybody's list? Probably not. Probably not. Not high on the list. It tells us about the values. I fear I'll lose money, I'll lose my job. Ah, yeah, that's important. Those are our values. You can say what you like your values are. The truth is, your values are the things you wrote down on that list. Those are the things that are important to you. Now you can develop and you can evolve. Once you're aware of that, you can develop and work on yourself. And in 2 years' time, that list might look different. But right now, that's a window into yourself as to what's truly important to you. The things you fear losing are the things that are truly important to you. So Hashem gave us an amazing gift as He expelled us from Gan Eden. He gave us limited life so that we can value things, and He gave us fear of loss so that we can value things. And that was the gift, that was the rachamim that He gives us as our gift into this world, which is no longer the protected world of Eden, where everything's just perfect, but this very difficult world where we're constantly having to trade. Why do we have to trade? Even if we're not in business, we have to trade. You have to trade time for results. You've got to trade one thing, can't do it all. Limited time. You've got to make choices. Choices is trade-off. So we enter the world of trade. We're trading values, we're trading all sorts of every minute of the day. You might not think of it, but every minute of the day we're trading. You're paying for something with something else every minute of the day because your life is ticking away. You've only got so much time, so you're paying with every second of it, at least on that level, and other things too. You've got to make a choice. Do I do this or do I that? Do I invest my energy and my effort in A or in B? We're constantly having to trade off as the gift to this. Into this new venture of the world of trade, Hashem gives us limited time, in other words, very valuable life, and fear of loss, so that we can understand what's important to us and take care of protecting it and truly valuing it. That's it for tonight. We'll pick up after Pesach.